Thank you, and welcome to today's webinar. This is the seventh in our series, exclusively for journalists, to give you the chance to look in detail at different aspects of the Affordable Care Act. And as you know, today we're focusing on women's health issues, the expanded access to coverage and preventive care for women under the ACA, and then we'll be looking more specifically at the Supreme Court issues, which will, of course, be starting around March the 25th with the upcoming hearing. So with that, I just want to remind you that the whole purpose of this is to provide you with a chance to ask questions, so feel free to do that via the chat as we're going along, and then we will get back to answering them at the end of these presentations by my colleagues, Alina Salgamikov, the Vice President and Director of the Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Foundation, and my colleague Laurie Sobel, the Senior Policy Analyst. I'm going to hand over straight to them because we've got quite a bit to cover today.
Great. Thanks so much, Penny. What Laurie and I want to do today with our time is to really provide you with an overview of some of the important changes that have occurred for women's health coverage and access as a result of the Affordable Care Act. I'm going to provide an overview of the major issues for women with a focus on eligibility for coverage and enrollment, preventive services, and also other benefits of importance to women, including maternity care and mental health. Laurie will then drill down further into the issues in play right now regarding contraceptive coverage and abortion coverage. Before we move ahead, I do think it's important to recognize that not only were women's groups on both sides of the aisle deeply engaged in the run-up to ACA, but other groups and constituencies also focused on the women's angle during the debate. Many women felt that they had much at stake, and many women's organizations have also been very engaged in the early stages of implementation. Why is this? Well, we know that women have a relationship with a healthcare system that's different than that of men. Their reproductive needs, their roles as family caregivers for parents, kids, and spouses, and the fact that they live longer with more chronic illness require that they interact with the health system at higher rates than men. In addition, a higher share of women than men are low income, and as a result, they are more sensitive to costs as it affects health. This data is from the monthly Kaiser Health Tracking Poll, and you can see here on every indicator, women, shown here in orange, report cost-related barriers to care at a higher rate than men, ranging from postponing or skipping care to taking medications to getting mental health care. One of the problems that the ACA was designed to address was the lack of access to affordable coverage that was experienced by millions of Americans. Before the coverage expansion took effect in January, nearly 1 in 5 adult women, that's 18.7 million women in the United States, was uninsured. This is shown here in the orange slice of the pie. It is anticipated that the majority of uninsured women will qualify for either Medicaid, tax credits to help with the cost of insurance, or be able to gain access to coverage through the state marketplace. That's regardless now of health status. Early enrollment data show that women comprise 54% of the new marketplace enrollees, despite having lower uninsurance rates than men. This highlights the value that many women place on coverage. However, many women, nearly 5 million of them, are not eligible for assistance. About 2.5 million uninsured women, shown here in the gray bar on the right column, are undocumented. These women are banned from receiving any assistance under the law. Another 2.4 million women are poor and in the coverage gap. This is because they reside in one of the 26 states that have decided not to expand Medicaid eligibility at this time. These states are shown here in orange and light blue. The ACA provides states with federal funding to expand Medicaid to all persons with incomes below 138% of the federal poverty level, regardless of family status. The Supreme Court ruling, however, essentially gave states the option of whether or not to expand Medicaid. As a result, about half of the states have chosen to keep eligibility rules at pre-ACA level. What this means is that poor women and men living in these states who are currently uninsured will not have access to affordable coverage because they don't qualify for Medicaid and are too poor to qualify for tax credits to enable them to afford coverage on the exchange marketplace. In addition to the coverage expansions, the ACA includes many reforms that affect access to insurance and the scope of coverage for women. Before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, parents were typically not allowed to keep their adult dependent children on their plan. It was perfectly legal for plans also to stop to apply pre-existing condition limitations on coverage. This included women who were pregnant or those who had a history of domestic violence or depression in addition to a history of other medical conditions. And these individually purchased plans rarely covered maternity care or charged women for expensive riders to cover maternity care. Today, adult children can stay on their parents' plans until they turn 26, and we've seen a reduction in the uninsurance rate in this age group by 5 percentage points in just 3 years. Furthermore, pre-existing condition exclusions and gender rating are banned, and all plans must cover maternity care. Another major change has been the requirement that new plans cover preventive services. The reason that this is so important is that for the first time, there is a federal requirement that plans cover preventive services. In the past, there was just a patchwork of state rules so that the extent of benefits that you receive depended on where you live and the type of plan that you were enrolled in. These rules now apply to all new private plans. This includes those that are self-insured, sometimes known as self-funded or ERISA plans, individual plans that are privately insured, as well as small and large group plans. Plans that are grandfathered, that is, they didn't change substantially since March 2010, are exempt. But it's anticipated that over time, most plans are going to lose their grandfather status and will provide these benefits. This benefit is also a requirement for the plans that are going to be available in the state marketplaces. I put this slide here to illustrate that this is a very large list of services. For adults, they include all the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended services, all immunizations recommended by the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and 8 new benefits noted here in red that were recommended by an IOM committee of women's health experts. These new services include the contraceptive coverage that's been the center of so much attention, but also breastfeeding support, intimate partner violence screening, and well women visits. Clearly, an important issue to follow will be how insurance plans will implement this new rule, as they are still permitted to use medical management rules to determine how they will cover these services. And while there's been lots of attention to these new benefits, particularly the contraceptive coverage rule, the evidence is clear, however, that having coverage does make a difference when it comes to getting preventive services, and that cost sharing can be a barrier to getting care for those who are insured. This data is data that we just collected in the late fall from the 2013 Kaiser Women's Health Survey. This is a sneak preview of some more new data that we will be releasing soon, and it shows that women with coverage get preventive services at higher rates than non-insured women, shown here in orange. It is worth noting, however, that utilization rates for many services are still below the goals that are set by the CDC's Healthy People 2020 target. Another issue that is very important for many women at some point in their lives, and I would say to men as well as fathers, is maternity care. Notably, pregnancy can no longer be considered a pre-existing condition as it was in the past. And maternity care and newborn care are included as one of the essential benefits that all plans must now cover. Maternity care was historically excluded from most individually purchased plans. Prenatal visits and recommended screenings, including breastfeeding support, including lactation consulting, and the cost of breast pump rental, are now covered without cost sharing, that is, free of cost. The law also made some changes to Medicaid, which currently funds nearly half of all births in the United States. This includes mandatory coverage of tobacco cessation, which was unevenly covered across the states, as well as coverage for all newborns that lack any other form of coverage. In addition, an issue that hasn't gotten much attention are the new workplace protections for nursing moms, which require that employers with 50 or more workers provide women with adequate break time and a private place to express milk that is not a bathroom. I also briefly wanted to touch on mental health issues, which are also critically important for women. Women and men differ in terms of how they experience mental health problems. As you can see here in the orange, anxiety, depression, PTSD, and panic disorders are experienced by women at nearly double the rates of men. Clearly, access to affordable coverage will help millions of women who have been uninsured obtain needed medical care. And because mental health is now an essential health benefit, it means that women who gain coverage on the exchange and in non-grandfathered individual plans will have mental health benefits on par with what they get with medical services. In the past, only 18% of individual policies even covered mental health care. And now women who can use these services without fear that it will be counted as a pre-existing condition should they need to secure coverage in the future. This was a legitimate concern for many in the past. And finally, I wanted to touch on the Medicare issue. This has gotten much less attention. Medicare also under Part B extends coverage to the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations as well as the yearly wellness visit. This is really important because half of women on Medicare live on incomes under $20,000 a year. So the fact that they can have first dollar coverage for preventive services is very important to these women. Now I want to turn it over to Lori, who's going to really focus now on the coverage of contraception and abortion coverage.
Hello, everybody. This is Lori Sobel. As part of preventative services under the ACA, all new private plans must cover the full range of FDA-approved contraceptive methods as prescribed at no cost to the consumer. This includes doctor's visits for counseling, insertion, removal, and follow-up. There are some exemptions and accommodations for some nonprofits that I will talk about in detail in a few minutes. As you can see in this slide, there is a wide range in cost for FDA-approved contraceptive methods. Keep in mind, a woman's reproductive lifespan is approximately 30 years. Women who could not previously afford contraceptives can now access the full range, including reliable, long-acting, reversible contraceptives like IUDs. There has been a lot of controversy and confusion about which employers are required to cover contraceptives. I'm going to walk you through this slide explaining exemptions and accommodations. Starting at the left, we have nonprofit houses of worship. These are churches, mosques, synagogues. These employers are exempt. The employer is not required to offer contraceptives, but they can if they have no religious objections. The employees of these employers that are houses of worship and their dependents do not have guaranteed coverage of contraceptives. Moving to the right, in the middle, in the dark blue, we have all for-profit employers. All for-profit employers must include contraceptive coverage. There are no exemptions or accommodations for for-profits. Now, on the far right, in the light blue, we have nonprofit employers that fall into two categories. There are secular nonprofit employers that are required to provide contraceptive coverage. Then on to the further right, we have the religiously affiliated nonprofit employers, like Notre Dame University or a Catholic hospital. These employers can get an accommodation if they self-certify that they object to providing contraceptive coverage based on religious grounds and provide a copy of their self-certification to their insurer or of their self-insured to the third-party administrator. This removes the burden of paying for the contraceptive coverage from the employer to the insurer or third-party administrator. So the employees and the dependents of these religiously affiliated nonprofits will receive the contraceptive coverage. It will just be directly from the insurer or the third-party administrator. More than 90 lawsuits have been filed by nonprofits and for-profits challenging the contraceptive coverage requirements. I'm going to focus on the two cases brought by for-profit employers, which will be heard by the Supreme Court in March. The two cases are Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, both for-profit, privately held companies. Hobby Lobby is a national chain of craft stores with over 13,000 employees. The owners are the Green family, which are Protestants and object to providing health insurance for IUDs and emergency contraceptives, including Ella and Plan B. Conestoga Wood Specialties is a wood cabinet manufacturer and has 950 employees. The owners, the Hahn family, are Mennonites and object to providing insurance coverage for Plan B and Ella. Both owners and companies are contending that the contraceptive coverage requirement, as applied to them, violates the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. At the heart of this litigation is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Congress passed this act in 1993. The act states that the government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless that burden is the least restrictive means to further a compelling governmental interest. Let's break down RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, to understand what the Supreme Court must consider in these cases. You see on this slide there are a series of questions, and depending on the answer, the court will either stop because there is no violation or move along to the next question. The first inquiry on the far left is whether the employer is a person that can exercise religion. This is the first time the Supreme Court will be considering this question, whether a for-profit can exercise religion. If the court answers this question yes, this will open a big door for for-profit companies asking for exemptions from other laws. Next, the court will move on to the second question. Does the requirement to provide health insurance for contraceptives substantially burden the employer? If the answer is yes, then we move to the third question. Does the government have a compelling interest to provide health insurance coverage for contraceptives? If the answer is no, then the law violates RFRA. If the answer is yes, we move on to the last question. Is this the least restrictive means of meeting this compelling interest? If the answer is no, then there is a violation of RFRA. If the answer is yes, then there is no RFRA violation. As I just mentioned, the Supreme Court's decision in these cases could have very far-reaching consequences. If the court holds that for-profit corporations can exercise religion, some employers may contend they have religious objections to various aspects of healthcare, including blood transfusions, vaccinations, infertility treatments, psychiatry treatment, and drugs, and health insurance altogether. Beyond healthcare, employers could ask to opt out of civil rights laws meant to protect people from employment and housing discrimination based on race, gender, religion, national origin, or pregnancy. I'm going to shift now to talk about insurance coverage for abortion. At the federal level, the ACA explicitly bans abortion as being included as an essential health benefit. State policies also shape coverage for abortion under Medicaid, state marketplaces, and private insurance. Under Medicaid, the Hyde Amendment limits the use of federal funds for abortion coverage only in the cases of rape, incest, and life endangerment. 33 states and D.C. limit abortion coverage in Medicaid to these circumstances. States can also prohibit plans in the state marketplace to include abortion coverage, and 24 states so far have done so. 9 states have banned or restricted abortion coverage in plans sold outside of the marketplace by private insurers in their state. So looking at this map, we see the availability of abortion coverage throughout the country. The 9 dark orange states are the states that I just mentioned that have restricted abortion coverage in Medicaid, the marketplace, as well as in private insurance sold in their state. The dark blue states are where there are no restrictions on abortion coverage. The light orange and yellow states are in the middle with 1 or 2 restrictions on abortion coverage and insurance plans, Medicaid, and the marketplace. This pie chart shows the availability of coverage for previously uninsured women ages 19 to 49 who are now eligible for coverage. As you can see with the dark blue, just over half of these women are eligible for coverage that includes abortion without restrictions. Just over one-third, or 3.9 million women, only have coverage options with restriction on abortion coverage. And 15%, 1.8 million poor women, fall in the coverage gap. But 99% of these women live in states that restrict abortion coverage under Medicaid. So even if their state expanded Medicaid, these women would still only have coverage with restrictions on abortion coverage. In summing up, here are some things to look for. Enrollment is clearly the number one priority for the administration, and women comprise a little more than half of early enrollees. But there are still 2.4 million poor women in the coverage gap with no access to affordable coverage. Under the ACA, and in addition to broadening coverage for maternity care and mental health, there is now a wide array of preventative services that are covered with no copay. These are important big changes. But continuing monitoring is necessary to enforce the no-cost preventative services for women and determine if there are still gaps. For reproductive services, there is still a lot in play. The Supreme Court's oral argument for Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties is on March 25th, and a decision is expected in June. Abortion coverage rules are still in play at the federal and state levels. So we'll stop there, and I'll turn it back to Penny to facilitate the questions.
Thank you. And just a couple of points which I forgot to cover at the beginning, which is one that we will post an audio version of this webinar on our website probably by the end of today, and shortly after that we will have a transcript available for those of you who might want to have that. And on a more substantive note, as we said at the beginning, please send in your questions via the chat function at any point now, and we will start answering that. But on a more substantive note, before we go any further, could you just go back over, we've had a question about Ella. Ella, Plan B, both mentioned as part of the Supreme Court March the 25th case.
Right. Ella and Plan B are both oral emergency contraceptives. Plan B is available over-the-counter, and Ella is a prescription medication that also is an emergency contraceptive. Ella, you need a prescription. Plan B is available over-the-counter.
And another clarification to questions. I'm sorry if there seems to be some mismatch between the slides coming up and the presentation. I don't know why that's happening, but all the slides will be available shortly after the end of this webinar, so you certainly have those. If you'd like us to go back over any of them now, here's your chance. Just shout. But otherwise, we are here and welcome any questions you may have. So please feel free to send them our way. So we're going to start now with a question from Marcel McGuinness. What are the likely effects of a ruling against the administration in the Hobby Lobby case?
This is Laurie Sobel. It depends on exactly how the court rules and how broad it is. If they rule that the for-profit companies do not have to provide contraceptives based on religious grounds, then we can foresee that many other for-profit companies might come forward. There's already 46 for-profits that have sued on grounds that they have religious objections to providing the contraceptive coverage. It's not obviously as big a case as the ACA challenge altogether, but it could have significant effects on the availability of contraceptive coverage through employers.
And on a follow-on from that, Nathan Elliott asks, Hobby Lobby says it only objects to abortion-inducing contraceptives, including Plan B, etc. Do you see a way for the court to accept this argument and possibly define two categories of contraceptives?
Well, this is Laurie again. The FDA has categorized both of those drugs as contraceptives. And based upon scientific evidence, they've made that determination. So I would think it would be highly unlikely that the court would then go around and try and overrule the FDA's determination of the category of those drugs.
Yeah, this is Alina Selganikov. There have been other scientific bodies have also reviewed the literature and find that these emergency contraceptives actually do not disrupt an implanted pregnancy.
We are going to go back now to the pie chart slide. I think there's only one of them.
There's two.
So I'm not quite sure, Chandra, if you want to just clarify which one you were going for, we can go over both of them. So we'll start by going over the one about abortion coverage for uninsured.
So what we're looking at here is the availability of coverage for newly insured women ages 19 to 49. These were women who were previously uninsured. And this is based upon the restrictions that different states have made on abortion coverage. So as you see, the dark blue, just over 50% of women will have access to coverage without restrictions on abortion. In the dark orange, we have about a third of the women, almost 4 million women, will have access to coverage but only with restrictions for abortion coverage. And then in the yellow, we have the women that still won't have any available affordable coverage, and they fall into the coverage gap.
And we came to these calculations by actually looking at the policies in each state and then looking at the women who would have been eligible in each of these categories.
So now we're going to go to the other pie chart in case that's going back to the beginning of the webinar.
Right. So this, what this does is really teases apart how women who are currently uninsured will qualify based on their income and based on the state that they live in. And so if you starting at the bottom, those are the women, 2.5 million women who are undocumented. That is, they are banned from receiving any federal assistance either through Medicaid and even purchasing coverage on the exchange. There's 2.4 million women who are in the coverage gap. Those are women who live in states that are not expanding Medicaid but are also poor. There are 4.4 million women who are going to be Medicaid eligible. There's another 6.8 million who are going to be eligible for tax credits. That is, their income is between either 100 or 138% of the poverty level, depending on their state, and 400% of poverty. And so they will receive subsidies in the form of tax credits, which will allow them to buy coverage. And then there's another 2.6 million whose income is too high to qualify for tax credits, but they also will qualify for care in the marketplace if they have a pre-existing condition or any other issue, and also will be able to get take advantage of the lower rates.
Here's a question from Maureen. How would the challenge from for-profit companies affect the challenge by non-profit groups like Notre Dame?
This is Lori again. So for the non-profits, I mean, you go through the same RFRA analysis, but they have a much easier time showing that they have the ability to exercise religion as a nonprofit religiously affiliated organization. The accommodation is different for the nonprofits in that category. So the question on the burden is different because essentially what they're required to do is to self-certify that they have religious objections to the contraceptive coverage and provide that certification to either their insurer or third-party administrator. So the analysis about the burden and would be different, but the analysis about the compelling interest as well as whether the government is meeting that compelling interest in the most restrictive way will be similar to the for-profit companies.
So here we're shifting slightly for a question from Kathleen Doney. Can you suggest any action points or advice for women trying to get coverage or women new to coverage? That's a pretty broad question, but accessing...
Right, so that's a great question because I think that, you know, what we're trying to do is not only reach women who have had coverage in the past, but there are a lot of women who have had no experience. And so a lot of those women are going to be... There are groups that are working with them. I think women can reach out to their clinics that they have been seeing. I know that a lot of the family planning clinics have people that are trained to help women enroll, as well as community health clinics. In addition to that, you know, the websites are at the state website and the federal websites are supposed to be working better, but there are a lot of the nonprofit groups have navigators as well that are trained to help women and individuals enroll.
Gail Pfeiffer asks, can you explain how patients cared for in free primary care clinics might be affected? I think that's sort of generally by under the ACA, but also perhaps specifically as regards...
Well, it really, again, it depends on your categorization. So the primary care clinics, the free clinics, that's the community health centers and other family planning clinics, are going to continue to be there, and there's still going to be a tremendous need to have these clinics because, as I mentioned earlier, there are 5 million women who are not going to be eligible for services but that are currently eligible for coverage but are currently residing in the United States. But in addition to that, a lot of women now who are using these clinics are now going to be eligible for coverage, either Medicaid or subsidized coverage through the exchange. So I think it is important for those women to contact their clinics if they want to continue that relationship to try to find out which of the plans their clinics are participating in so they can continue to have seamless coverage and make sure that that network includes their clinic.
Just to be clear, that was Alina speaking.
Yes.
Sorry, we didn't identify ourselves. And now a question from Susan Jaffe. You mentioned there are concerns about the implementation of free preventive health benefits. Can you give some examples of access problems?
Well, this is Lori. For the contraceptive coverage, there is a under the guidelines, plans are allowed to use reasonable medical management to implement that provision. And so what that generally means is that they can require women to obtain a generic birth control pill rather than a brand name birth control pill. But we don't know what other provisions plans are going to be using in terms of tiering or putting up barriers to some of the more expensive contraceptive coverage for women. So that's what we need to have continuing monitoring around that implementation.
Yeah, and I think even if you look even beyond contraceptive coverage, if you look at, for example, the breastfeeding support, who are the providers who are going to be actually qualified to provide the lactation consultation, what types of breast pumps are going to be available, around the intimate partner violence, how is that screening going to be done? How are the referrals going to be handled? The evidence is there that screening and referral and counseling does make a difference in terms of reducing harm for women who are experiencing intimate partner violence, but this is a new issue for both healthcare providers and insurers to cover now, and so I think that there is going to be a large learning curve.
So now Chandra White Cummings asks, has the establishment clause come into the Hobby Lobby case at all? This was an op-ed today, an editorial piece in the New York Times today, but Laurie.
Right. So the establishment clause, just to remind everybody of your legal 101, is basically that the government and the church need to be separate and that the one cannot impose their religion on somebody else. And so this wasn't briefed very much in the case, in the government's case. It was just dropped as a footnote. Marcy Hamilton, a professor at Cardozo School of Law, has written an amicus brief writing at length about this, and the New York Times today just had an editorial suggesting that the court asked for a briefing on this issue specifically. So, and in addition, just in case folks don't know, in the Notre Dame lawsuit, the students have intervened as a party, as an anonymously, but represented by counsel as a party in that case, basically saying that they have a stake in the case because they, as students, will not have access to contraceptive coverage if Notre Dame is allowed to not provide it, and the accommodation is considered to be a burden on them. So there's been more and more talk about how this affects both the students in university settings as well as the employees in the employment setting.
Well, now we're being asked sort of crystal ball gazing questions, and I'm not sure how capable or willing we are to answer either of them, but here we go. Mary Silver asks, what do you predict about states relenting about accepting the Medicaid expansion? Alina, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Yeah, well, I think that there's been, one is that there's been some kind of interest in some of the states, go back to the Medicaid map, please, in some of the states in looking at alternatives to the Medicaid expansion in Indiana and Pennsylvania, for example, so that there are some states that are kind of looking at slightly different ways that they can reach this, cover this population, at least through the private sector. But in addition to that, I think it is also important to have some historical perspective in terms of just Medicaid implementation over time. Medicaid was not a required program. The states could participate. They didn't all participate initially when the program was enacted in 1965. And in fact, I think Arizona was the last state to join Medicaid in the 1980s. So I think that, you know, over time we will see more and more states, particularly I think as people realize that that there is an inequity there, that you'll have people that are the poorest in the state without a pathway to either Medicaid or access to subsidies because of the way the law is written, and people who have slightly higher incomes eligible to get tax credits. So I think over time we will see more and more states. And I think also the safety net providers, the hospitals also will push for these changes as they have been.
And Marcel McGuinness asks, what are the likely effects of a ruling against the administration in the Hobby Lobby case?
Go to the,
So beyond the case itself, this any ruling that would rule in favor of for-profits having religious rights would have much broader ramifications. Again, this is the first time the court is looking at this issue of whether a for-profit company can exercise religion. And a lot of people point to Citizens United, and that was a free speech case. This is different. This is about the ability to have to exercise religion. And so in the healthcare context, it really could, you could see a new wave of employers that basically contend that they're parts of the healthcare law or parts of providing health insurance conflict with their religious beliefs, and they want to opt out of those provisions. But beyond that, this case really has very far-reaching consequences in terms of civil rights, because employers could basically contend that the civil rights laws violate their religion, and that, you know, they don't believe that unwed people should live together, so they're not going to hire people who are living together that are not married. You can go from there and see, you know, you can imagine the very large consequences that this could have. There's others, you know, just to keep in mind, there's many amicus briefs that have been filed in Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods. I think at last count it was 81 amicus briefs. And there's lots of businesses that are submitting amicus briefs in support of the government in these cases, because they see this as a threat to the corporate structure, and that they would then might be liable in a different way than before if suddenly corporations could have religious rights.
Anna Catherine Brigadier asks Alina. Alina, you spoke briefly about a change in coverage for women who experience domestic violence. And under the ACA, what additional services will be covered under the ACA? And could you talk in more depth about the implications of this change?
Sure. So this this slide, and this is also available in a Kaiser brief on women and health reform. But I think that it is really important, this is really an important point, because I think that a lot of the attention has been focused on a lot of the eight new services. But these services really span from looking at cancer, screening, and protection. Recently, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force also said that preventive medication for women who test positive for BRCA will be covered free of cost sharing. In addition, cervical cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening, screening for a wide range of chronic conditions that affect cardiovascular health, diabetes, depression, as well as osteoporosis and obesity. All of that vaccines for women and now men. The HPV vaccine has been, initially was a vaccine that was very expensive, and so there were some issues there. Now these are all covered without cost sharing. In addition, counseling and screening around a wide range of healthy behaviors and lifestyles. Everything from looking at alcohol misuse and overuse, diet counseling, and tobacco cessation, as well as now the IPV that I mentioned. In addition, there's a lot there for pregnant women, and I think that that's really important. You know, we know that, you know, part of the big push for the Medicaid expansions for pregnant women was to get women in earlier. The screening and detection now, and with our ability to do many more interventions, it's critically important to make sure that we have healthy moms and healthy babies. And in addition to that, now we have a wide range of reproductive and sexual health screening and counseling that is now covered. So that, you know, a lot of the really important kind of preventive services, and by that I mean screening, early detection, and conditions which really are amenable to an early intervention, which prevent problems in the long run, are now available, guaranteed to women who have the coverage.
Gail Pfeiffer asks about Medicaid providers, since providers have an option whether or not they accept Medicaid payments. What happens when Medicaid providers are not available in a particular area for the uninsured or for the newly insured?
Hi, this is Alina Salgyanikov. So you've touched on a really, I think, an important issue, which is Medicaid has historically been a very low payer compared to private insurance and Medicare. And so there have been issues related to provider participation in Medicaid, where there are providers have a choice on whether or not they are willing or unwilling. The bigger challenge has usually been around private physicians, much less than hospital clinics or health centers, not accepting Medicaid. So some have raised concerns that there will be insufficient providers that are available. People are going to be enrolling in Medicaid, probably in private Medicaid plans, so it is hoped that there will be sufficient providers. But I do think that this is an important area that will, I think, generate attention. I think at this point we don't know. We do know that individuals with Medicaid have better access to care, but in terms of whether or not they're actually, you know, whether we're going to have a sufficient provider network to see people on time, in a reasonable time, I think will vary a lot from state to state and community to community.
And, of course, it's been an issue before the Affordable Care Act, too. Judy Perez asked, Aline, I think this is a follow-up clarification to you, please. Did you say breast cancer chemo prevention will be covered without copay only for BRCA carriers?
Yeah, I believe it's for the BRCA carriers. Yeah, so if you're at high risk, and BRCA carriers are a high risk group. So yeah,
maybe just go through BRCA.
BRCA is there are two genetic mutations. It's two genetic mutations that are related to a higher risk of breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2. Now there are genetic tests that can detect women who carry this mutation. Those women are at a higher risk for getting breast cancer. And so now there are chemo preventions, there are medications that are available that can reduce, these are medications that in the past have been given to women who have had breast cancer, but now are available to women who have not yet had breast cancer, but are at high risk.
I think we're more or less covering all the questions here, and we're beginning to run out of time. If there are follow-up questions, or if we can do a follow-up response more effectively by an email, we certainly will. And I think with that, we are, unless you have any closing points, I think we will.
No, I would say, you know, that there, I mean, just in general as a closing point, there's, you know, clearly a lot of ground to cover here in terms of the women's health issues. I do think that, you know, in terms of kind of looking forward and thinking about kind of what types of stories to cover, I think that there is, you know, the contraceptive coverage and the abortion are really, really touchstones. This is Alina Salgyanikov. My colleagues here are flagging me saying, who are you? To look at, you know, the implementation, I think the preventive services and, you know, is kind of the promise of the law really being fulfilled in terms of the coverage, looking at the networks that are there. Are those networks, do they have the specialists that women need? Are the maternity care benefits and the mental health benefits really, you know, accessible? And I think that there's going to be lots of different stories, really depending on kind of different communities and different women are going to have different experiences. but I think that there's still a lot more to kind of unfold and learn about in terms of women's experiences.
Oh, well, that's raising a question which is worth touching on here from Gail Piper. Do you have a feel for how the ACA will affect charity care in local hospitals? I mean, that's a broad question, but
I think a lot of it will depend on the charity care. There's still going to be a need for local hospitals to provide charity care. The net for the ACA will reach many people, and those hospitals who have more insured patients, either through Medicaid or through private insurance, will have a revenue source. But there will still be significant numbers of people who are uninsured, and those hospitals will still be obligated to provide care for those individuals, particularly in cases of emergency care. So we will still very much need a very robust healthcare safety net, both in terms of charity hospitals, but also in terms of the vast network of community health clinics and family planning providers.
So just as a reminder, there are many resources on our Kaiser website, kff.org. We're here to answer questions, and just to put a plug in for Alina Salganikov, in case it's relevant for you or for your audiences, as she is a bilingual Spanish-speaking expert, which may be useful to some of you to know. Again, we will have all the slides and the presentations up on our website later today, and we will get a transcript as quickly as we can. And in the meantime, thank you very much for your interest. And this is Penny Duckham saying thank you very much as we finish up this webinar. If you have ideas for other issues that would be useful to go into in some depth, please let us know.